WDIY News is pleased to welcome back Dr. Jeffrey Jerry for a Lehigh Valley coronavirus update. He is the Senior Vice President of Medical and Academic Affairs and Chief Emeritus of Infectious Disease Specialists with St. Luke's University Health Network. Welcome, Doctor.
Hi, James. It's so good to be with you and your audience again.
Our pleasure as well. What have we learned about the novel coronavirus on a local level? Your personal experience or St. Luke's University Health Network's experience with their patients?
That's an excellent question because there is a lot to be learned. And I always start off with one of the things that is most important is that you have to learn to be humble with this. So let me go through some of the things that I think that we have learned that could be very useful to an individual. First of all, we know that some of the things that have been timely and established over a long history, such as social distancing and the wearing of masks, is useful. That alone is what can help stop the disease. That's a lot different than talking about what businesses should be shut down and how. There's a lot of controversy surrounding that, but there should be no controversy surrounding some of the basic issues in terms of social distancing and the wearing of masks. In addition, we also know that we have gained a great deal of knowledge in getting supplies and figuring out how we're going to extend those supplies. I can give you some examples. At the very beginning, it was very clear to us that there was not enough PPE or personal protective equipment. So if I want to give a local example of what my own hospital has done, we were the first hospital to talk about 3D printing of masks, and we have actually patented a particular type of mask that is very useful. We've also patented a sterilizing system, an ultraviolet sterilizing system that is specifically for some of the advanced masks, the N95 masks, that can prolong its use. And in addition, we have invested in a United States company that will actually be making protective equipment so that on a number of different fronts, we are in a much better position. And I think that's true of many other hospitals than we were at the beginning of this epidemic, as we are facing a potential for an increase in the future. We also know that certain treatments are very effective right now that we were not aware of in the beginning. In the very beginning, it was thought that maybe putting people on a ventilator early on would be helpful. We know that that's absolutely not the case right now, and there are all kinds of maneuvers to try and prevent people from going on a ventilator. We have made use of many of the drugs, some of the things that we talked about that President Trump has been on in combination, and we know how to use those much better than we did in the beginning, and our results have been really exemplary in terms of lowering our mortality. We also have better monitoring systems for patients when we have them who are not admitted to a hospital. There are a lot of different devices that we use to try and keep in touch with our patients and to know whether they might need to be seen more often or actually be admitted. And we've been part of that whole process using certain kinds of instruments known as Masimo that can give us really minute-to-minute readouts on a patient, whether they're in a hospital or out of the hospital, and that's been very, very useful. So on a variety of different fronts, I think that we've made a tremendous amount of progress, but there's so much more that needs to be done. We're finding out now, for instance, that many people who seem to have very little in the way of symptoms, or for that matter, asymptomatic, could have some long-term effects, and they have to be monitored in patients. There's a worry about increased propensity for heart attacks or having certain heart muscle diseases, as an example. So once you're done with this disease, it doesn't mean that you're through with it, that we have the ability right now to know that long-term follow-up is absolutely necessary. So what I want to point out is that anyone who comes down with this disease in this area is going to be in a much better position than they would have been back in March when there was almost nothing that was known about the disease at all. But at the same token, there is still a lot that we have that are gaps that we need to be able to fill in order to be able to give optimal therapy. Again, there is no official approved drug, and we all look forward to that, and we all look forward to an effective and safe vaccine.
Are we still in a wave or wave one, or have we moved into a second wave? Apparently, the reporting is that South Korea has moved into a second wave. Is that something we're experiencing, not only in the United States, but locally?
What happened was that back in April, we were really at a peak. And I had mentioned that even when we looked at our own hospitalizations within our 11 hospital network, we were up to something like 350 patients that were hospitalized with COVID or highly suspected COVID. It then dropped down to the point where a few weeks ago we were actually in single digits. Now what we are seeing is an increase. It is nowhere near what we had in April. So instead of seeing 8, 9, 10 patients within our network that are hospitalized, we might now have somewhere anywhere between 15 and 25. So that is a substantial increase, but it isn't the kind of increase that you could say is going to massively affect us. It might be an early warning sign. Was that totally unexpected? No, it was not, because we knew that once schools open, and that includes both universities, colleges, as well as K through 12, that there would be some increase in cases as people got out more. And also once there was a certain loosening up in our society with people out and about much more, and in many cases dropping some of the precautionary elements that were in place initially, that we would see this increase in case. And then we obviously have a change in weather, that we're going to be spending more time indoors, and other variables. So the real question is this going to persist? Is it going to get a lot worse? We don't know. We don't know what the effect of an influenza season is likely to be. If we look at the Southern Hemisphere, where they usually have an influenza season much earlier than we do, they've had almost no influenza season because people are taking the precautions for COVID that would also help prevent influenza. And I think we're going to have a much better success rate in getting people to take the vaccine. But nonetheless, I think it is something that we have to be aware of, that we are seeing an increase of cases and an increase in hospitalizations, although it isn't exponentially dramatic, and it's just a warning sign. So whether you want to call that a second phase or not, I'll leave the nomenclature up to you or the actual title. But for us, it bears constant watching.
Seems like an ongoing process, not really waves.
I wouldn't call it an actual wave, exactly. It's more of an evolution.
With that said, and great segue, obviously the vaccine is something everyone is looking for. Is there any updates as far as the multiple candidate trials that are out there? Is there a timeline possible? Has that been updated? And when the vaccine does arrive and it's been confirmed by science and doctors, what kind of rollout process would it look like?
There are now worldwide over 170 different vaccine candidates that are in development. To put it on a more local level, there are 7 vaccines that are in trials in the United States, of which 4 currently are in the latter stages or latter trials, which we call a phase 3. Of those 4, there are several leading candidates that I would put into that, but there's only one that is a single-dose vaccine, and the others are dual doses that are separated by 1 month apart. So there is a certain amount of time that has to take place after you give the vaccine in order to see whether it's totally effective. These phase 3 trials not only involve thousands of patients, but they have to involve the risk groups of the people that you would want to receive this vaccine. So that if you're only giving it to young people, that's not going to tell you what older people, how they're going to respond. If you only give it to certain groups where males outnumber females or females outnumber males or certain ethnic groups are not represented, that's also not a fair trial. So a lot of work has to be done in order to make sure that you're going to get the kind of effect or expect the kind of effect in the population that you want it to receive this drug. That takes time to do. We do know that one of the vaccines has been temporarily halted, and that's the AstraZeneca vaccine, because there was a case of what's called transverse myelitis, which is a very serious complication. And in the right spirit, and that's what you're expected to do, until they can be sure that that case was not going to be replicated in other individuals, or to be sure that it either was or wasn't associated with the vaccine, they've halted their phase 3 trial. So with all of that, I would say that it's very unlikely, almost impossible in my mind, that you're going to see any kind of a rollout of a vaccine before Election Day. It is possible that we could start to see a phased rollout in late November and then ongoing. what is this phase rollout? And this has already been developed by the Center for Disease Control, and it was announced actually on September the 16th that the vaccine initially will be released, if all things work out well, in a very, very limited amount, because we won't have data to be able to show that it's useful for the entire population, nor will we have enough vaccine to give to the entire population. So that first phase of rollout, it will be distributed by governmental agencies, the HHS, and then to the State Department of Health, who then will decide how it will be distributed throughout the state. We do know that the first receivers of this limited amount of vaccine would be first responders who are in direct contact and high risk for the disease from patients, and that would include medical workers, fire, police, EMTs, etc. It would also include the highest risk groups, and we mentioned that earlier, that the highest risk group would be those who are aged and who are infirm, particularly in nursing homes, and who have major underlying comorbidities. Then, as more vaccine becomes available, that second phase would roll out, and we would cover a lot of the people who were not hit in that first phase, who were in those particular designations, but now, in addition, other essential occupations, food service workers, transport workers, etc. And then finally, when there is absolutely enough vaccine and there's a lot of good safety data as well as efficacy data and we have enough supplies, it will then be given a general rollout where anyone in the population will be able to avail themselves of the opportunity to get that. I think till we get to that last phase, it's very unlikely that we're, even under the best of circumstances, that you're likely to see that before the summer of this coming 2021. But it would not be beyond the pale to see that first phase roll out if we actually have some very good results in this vaccine, again, in a very limited quantity, sometime in either late November or December. Unfortunately, there's a lot of discordant information that's out there. And you're seeing this also not just from the White House or from the CDC. As you know, the CDC has changed their mind on a number of different things that have gone through, but also from the makers of the vaccine themselves. Sometimes there is an announcement by the CEO of a particular drug company that makes a vaccine that said that by such and such a date, we should have several million doses that will be readily available, and then we can rapidly scale up to 50 million doses if we have to. Again, a lot of this is conjecture. So I prefer to be conservative on this, and only time will tell. And the rollout that I gave you right now, I don't think is totally unrealistic. Is it possible that we could see a general distribution if everything works perfectly well before next summer? Well, everything is possible. But if you're asking us to guesstimate, the time period that I gave you, I think, is more realistic.
St. Luke's University Health Network has announced a tuition reimbursement program for medical practitioners and family doctors, as I understand.
Yeah. As you know, we have our own clinical campus of Temple Medical School that is a full 4 years that the students now are spending with us. At one time, it was a 3-in-1 where they spent their first year down in Philadelphia and the last year here, the last 3 years here. Now they spend all 4 years over here. We've done a lot in terms of trying to make certain that not only are they getting the best education, which we have very good proof of because they tend to rank right at the top of their classes and do very well on standardized exams, but that they are likely then to stay in our area. So one of the things that we're doing and that we've done for quite some time is that the students are given a prorated tuition reimbursement over the full 4 years that they're here so that by the time that they leave, they essentially get 1 year of tuition that's totally paid for. In addition, if they are taking part in St. Luke's residencies, particularly some of the residencies that we feel are very much needed in the community, psychiatry, primary care, internal medicine, and family medicine, that, again, there's additional monies that are given to them. And then if they actually not only take the residency, but work within our network, essentially all of their medical school will be paid for. All of their medical school tuition would be paid for, and that's prorated. So all of these act as an encouragement, first of all, so that students who ordinarily may not be able to afford to go to medical school have that now, that opportunity to do so. And secondly, that we encourage students that we want to be able to stay in our area and particularly in the specialties that we find are underserved.
Sounds like a great opportunity.
It is, and it's been very successful so far.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Jerry of St. Luke's University Health Network. We appreciate your time and expert information.
I hope that was helpful. It's always a pleasure, James. And I hope that you, your family, and your colleagues are staying safe and healthy.
For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting.